reason why this is so important in church history is because even the most Orthodox today are very hesitant to assign a role to this. Even though, thankfully, it's a bit like Francis Schaeffer being a presuppositionalist, yet mercifully, blessedly, acting in life and ministry in a way that's classical. So he does engage with the unbeliever, and so he's not entirely consistent with that little bad part of his theology. Well, same thing here. The new Calvinism, to the degree that they're A, Baptist, B, American, C, nominalist, at least, because they're so Orthodox and Christian and biblical, at least has instincts to do something like what Al Mohler did at Southern. That's the right thing to do. That would be happening 20 to 1 more if this movement was realist. They'd be wasting less time with missional mumbling and more time building up the fortress of Orthodoxy and not thinking that somehow at odds with charity and humility and missionalness and stuff like that. But that's a side note. That's why this is important, to breathe into our system and to see what this stuff really is and what they're so afraid of. Other prominent realists throughout the scholastic tradition, before I get to Aquinas, a guy named William of, is it Shampoo in the French? No, it's Champeau. His dates are 1070 to 1121, and then there's Hugh of St. Victor. Ha-ha. But I'm going to call him Hugo, because his other name is Hugo. I don't want to get anyone confused with Hugh of St. Boise here. William held, now these are both realists. William held to an extreme form of realism again, in which the substance of a universal was present in any species of a genus. So here's one mistake I guess you can make if you really are into making mistakes on purpose. For example, Joe is a man and Bill is a man. So if we take the realist position, man is anterior to and determinative of particular men. The essence of man comes before, has a priority over particular men. They are participating in what Schaeffer called the mannishness of man. All right. Well, that would mean that if Bill moves across the sea to Scotland and Joe remains in America, then Joe is both in Scotland and America, and so is Bill all at once. Now, it's hard to tell whether this is a caricature of such ultra-realists or not. Certainly the nature of man, in other words, what makes a man, is in both places, but it's not a geographically bound substance any more than it's divided between two particular men. So that's just a silly misunderstanding. The other guy, Hugo, was a mystic who drew out of a realist doctrine of God and the soul a practical means by which the Christian can live the truly spiritual life. So just listen to this one paragraph, just an example of how realism flows forth into a sane, rational, good, biblical way of the Christian life. As God was an invisible spirit, so the essential part of a man is in invisible communion with God. As God brought the world out of chaos in 6 days, so the image of God is to bring rational order to the raw materials of his vocation 6 days a week. Both of those are clearly taught in Scripture, but people have the animal-like tendency to drift away from that or to minimize that. So God as spirit and as creator or creative determines how the image bearer, the spiritual dimension of him, will be then the highest dimension. That doesn't minimize the body, but God is a spirit. And so that in God, that the man, that the human being, that the soul is to commune with, will have a spiritual dimension. And as God created, so man is to be at least creative in that way. The one is going to determine the other. The form of the divine image is going to dictate the particulars of the image in his action. That's realism. And it's obviously scriptural. Scripture assumes realism. I bring in Hugo there only because his importance for us is to show how the realist conception of Christianity is comprehensively practical and that it makes for a different way of life in virtually every area of life. If you take an opposite view of realism, you're going to get different interpretations of the most fundamental things in Scripture. You're going to mess up everything. Peter Abelard is one of these thinkers, 1079 to 1142. He was a bit of a people are, whether or not he was sort of a chameleon of sorts. He wrote a book called Yes and No. That's already a bad start right there. But really, all that means is he was contrasting statements of the church fathers and deriving a method. He really improved upon Aristotle's logic, brought it into the Middle Ages. So it's sort of an A and non-A. A synthesis, not like Hegel, thesis, antithesis, but to resolve which one is true by means of seeing something else, and that's how you reconcile these two things.
It's like a Masonic symbol, doesn't it?
But that's basically a description of the kind of thinking that scholastic thinking does. It reconciles things to derive, in a sense, some third truth. Now, Abelard didn't really help people. They never really resolved the tension, but he gave a logical, systematic way in which people could... He also took that, I was mentioned in that fourth position, conceptualism. Remember extreme nominalism? Moderate nominalism? Sorry. Extreme realism, moderate realism, nominalism. Well, conceptualism is often put out as another mediate position, but really, see if you can see which this is closer to. Conceptualism agrees with the nominalist that universals only ever exist in particulars. Yet it agrees with the realist that they are more than a mental creation. They must be an intellectual or a conceptual subsistence, something that is eternal or maybe an idea of God's. A Christian conceptualism will at least agree with the realist that these universals are uncreated by a creature's mind. So they're not subjective. If they're created in any sense, these are of God, and they are at least known objectively and exhaustively by God's mind. Now, if you state it in that way, the conceptualist position is a lot closer to realism than nominalism, and in fact, might just be a better expression of realism. One interesting note on Abelard, sort of a side note, after falling in love with a woman named Heloise, and marrying in secret, the uncle of the young lady, who was much more powerful than him, sought revenge and obtained it by having the professor emasculated. Literally. Those things are worth covering in church history, just because it's just the time they lived in. He was 36 years old when that happened, though he would live another 27 years, the last few in a remote monastery after he had made more enemies. But if you look at his manifest theology, Abelard really was heretical. He was essentially a modalist. He was a semi-Pelagian, though closer to Pelagius than most semi-Pelagians. And he's the one, you might remember this from our atonement class, that first came up with the moral influence theory of the atonement. In other words, that the main thing the cross did was that it affected the heart by expressing God's love and therefore moving on the heart to love God. Okay. Now, does the atonement do that? Yes. Is that the central element? Is that the ground of the atonement? I would say no. But anyway, it's Peter Abelard that came up with that. Another Peter Lombard, his dates are 1096 to 1164, wrote a book called The Sentences, pretty much doing the same thing, reconciling the church fathers, but he really comes up with the systematic theology. So sort of a God, creation, salvation, church, last things, that order in these four volumes of his, was in a sense, and now a lot of people say, well, he invented the word theology. Now, whether that's the case or not, he didn't invent the concept, because theology is nothing but the academic subject or discipline for which doctrine comprises the elemental parts. So I don't care whether or not he invented the term, he didn't invent the idea. But again, these thinkers, all of these thinkers, understood that this superior mind liberated because the truth will set you free. Jesus said that, John 8:32. And by contrast, the inferior mind, the disintegrating mind, the mind no longer acting as the image bearer, prepares us to lose our grip, not only on some abstract doctrine called realism, but to lose our grip of order, of God's order, and let all hell loose upon the earth. John of Salisbury, Josh already covered him in his political writings, but his dates are 1120 to 1180. John is really one of the most foremost thinkers in the realm of political philosophy and education. His work, The Politocraticus, is what Josh talked about, and he's using his realism. He's moving from the essence of law to its particulars in civil law, in which it's participating in justice, and then the office holder, the legislator, is a servant of that, as he sees how this lines up with this divine law. That'll show back up in Aquinas. But John really draws that out, and he wrote another book called the Metalogicon in 1159, entirely devoted to demonstrating that grammar must precede logic in the order of the student's comprehension. So remember, the trivium mirrored the way the soul actually operated. So you had this formative stage. Grammar didn't mean exactly like, you know, language construct, although it included that. It was just the info, the content. The second stage of a child's development, I guess from age 10 to age 13 or so, 14, synthesize that content. And of course, they have the old word that Plato used, dialectic, for that. So in his book, basically he's asking, you know, what is there to synthesize and to deduce if not the objects of reality outside of the mind which classifies and infers? You have to get the stuff first. And children are exactly that kind of thing. You open up the package and boom, they are exactly the kind of things that their soul is reflected by this form of education. They're sponges. They don't ask why, they just do it. And then when they start asking why, bam, logic. They already act like this. All you're doing is conforming your philosophy of education to the reality of the soul, which soul conforms to the reality of reality outside of the soul. So notice the university of all these objects. So John says in this book, quote, "Grammar is the cradle of all philosophy, and in a manner of speaking, the first nurse of the whole study of letters. Accordingly, those who would banish or condemn grammar are in effect trying to pretend that the blind and deaf are more fit for philosophical studies than those who, by nature's gift, have received and still enjoy the vigor of all their senses. On this connection between the first and the second stages, grammar and logic," John continues, "just as grammar is concerned with ways of saying things, dialectic is concerned with what is said. While grammar chiefly examines the words that express meanings, dialectic investigates the meanings expressed by words. A word's force consists in the meaning." Let me finish out that chart, because what you're going to see here is that the soul is already doing this, and this is going to reflect the whole philosophy of everything besides the soul. In other words, your understanding of truth, how it works, your understanding of what knowledge is. Remember the scholastic, the two basic things that the scholastics, that characterize scholasticism, objectivism, an objective view of things, and therefore an objective view of knowledge. So, notice that the philosophy, theology, psychology, and education are all fitting each other. Not because it was neatly fit together, but because they discovered that it does go together like this. Everything mirrors everything, the same thing as everything else, because everything was meant to speak about a God who is completely ordered and never contradicts himself. The truly Christian philosophy of education, in other words, is wholly objective with respect to its epistemological foundation and wholly realist with respect to its metaphysical foundation. If you ask me what would typify a Christian philosophy, one of my responses is you'll have to look beyond our generation. You won't find it. It would be something like an objective realism. There'd be elements of it that are taught today in guys like R.C. Sproul, but he's a pastor. He doesn't have time to draw this out. Or guys like Paul Helm, who gets Calvinism in addition to getting classical understanding, but then there's other elements he doesn't get. It's hard to find anyone today who takes this seriously. They're afraid of too much. They have too many entrenchments. and too many false fears built up by 19th and 20th century theology. Grammar and logic are what they are as stages of an intellect's development, because the reality outside and the truth about that reality are what they are. The reality that is infinitely bigger than the soul determines how we operate on the individual soul with ideas. This is important for notice the same thing's going on with counseling. I just did a thing on Saturday. Same thing. Every part of the Christian life, same thing. How do you preach? Same thing. How do you talk to your kids? Same thing. Everything is just like this. Theology, what's the relationship between theology and philosophy? You know, we're taking all this seriously, and it's like, oh my goodness, swimming in this stuff, and I know plenty of people who are Orthodox who don't think about this stuff. I know. That's true. So naturally, a lot of people confuse the relationship between theology and philosophy. Theology is authoritative for philosophy in these medieval thinkers' minds. Yet, philosophy is foundational for theology in a different way. There are whole schools of apologetics today, and at the seminary, who confuse those two things. In other words, if foundational, therefore authoritative. If authoritative, therefore foundational, at the same time in the same relationship. And so there are confusing categories there. Something can be foundational for something else without being authoritative. Let me give you a couple of examples. Did you learn to read before you read the Bible? I did. I suspect 100% of people did, except for the Puritans. They teach their kids to read by shoving their head in the Bible. Right? But everybody else, you learn to read outside of the Scriptures. You idolater. You're making the Scriptures rest on the ABCs. Sounds stupid, doesn't it? It is stupid. There's entire seminaries and schools of thought today devoted to that kind of sloppy thinking. And as a result, they scare us away from the categories of what are called natural theology.
Is that autonomous reading?
Yeah. You're autonomous ABCing, yeah. Autonomous Sesame Street. Now that really is autonomous reasoning right there. Because there's a bunch of... Anyway. But here's the thing. Your understanding, if you didn't understand how to correctly pronounce words or understand how articles function or prepositions or things like that, that's going to undergird proper philosophy of things is going to either undergird or undermine its most orthodox commitments, depending on how solidly it commits itself to the objectivity of objects. It is for this reason that underneath all of this classical learning and natural theologizing and scholastic method, there was that one idea so critical that it becomes virtually impossible to recover once it's lost, and that is that aforementioned metaphysical doctrine of realism. You can, if you lose something that's foundational, part of the problem is you can't just recover it by saying, you know, that thing. If everybody in the world tonight forgot how to speak English, everybody, good luck trying to reintroduce it overnight. You could build it back up, but you can't say to people, well, kind of like, where are you going to look? It's gone. It's lost. There's no categories. In fact, there's categories, in this case, it's poor analogy in some cases, in some ways. This is the kind of thing, if you don't believe in the reality of objects, if that's not familiar language to you, if all this stuff is like big words and stuff, when in fact they were the first things you needed to know for centuries, it's going to be difficult to build that back up. It's going to seem weird and jumbled and thick. A couple other guys I'm not going to get into because I don't think they're as important. But the medieval synthesis, that's the idea here in the second session. It's competitors. The medieval scholastics pretty much believe that theology is the queen of... Oh, here's the thing. Maybe here's another problem going on here. As I'm talking about this, you think, okay, this is the philosophy that undergirds theology. Here's the problem with that. Everything I've talked about is utterly theological first and only secondarily philosophical. These are philosophical words today in isolation because we don't have the university, because Christians aren't committed to the idea that all truth is God's truth. But if I start with the assumption that everything is a theological thing because God made all things to speak about himself, then philosophy as much as it transcends all the other disciplines, this is a solar system. Let me give you two pieces of imagery here. Theology is like the sun in the system of learning, and all these other planets orbiting that are the sciences and the humanities. Philosophy is the gravity that keeps them in check. Notice that none of these things can ask questions that all of these things share in common. For example, biology and chemistry, and physics for that matter, study, at first, on the surface, different objects, different phenomena. All of them, though, have to use sentences. All of them relate to quantity. All of them use relational knowledge, logic, the relation between one thing and another. And the way that that's sort of crystallized is a method that they all share called the scientific method. Question. Which science studies the scientific method? In other words, from which science did the scientific method derive? None of them. It's not a scientific thing. The synthesis of observation, hypothesis, test, rinse and repeat. I mean, whatever, you fail, you do this, you don't, you go back. And then in the 20th century, more honest scientists came along and said, actually, you don't start with observation, you bring assumptions, and that's not a bad thing, but you have paradigms, you have personal commitments, and so on and so forth, you have presuppositions. In fact, all of the assumptions that enter the lab room are themselves philosophical commitments, which cannot be sliced and diced on the lab table. So in fact, philosophy, all it's doing is asking the questions and setting the parameters for these things won't ask and can't ask. They're not scientific-type things, or artistic things for that matter. They're questions that transcend these things. They're dealing with metaphysical things that these things are ultimately participating on, or in, or depend on. Okay? So the medieval scholastics had a saying, theology is the queen of all sciences, and philosophy is her handmaiden. And all they meant by that is that theology is the content. So another piece of imagery, it's really doing the same thing, is to think of this as a mountain. All the content, all the water that flows down comes from this glacier of theology. And the bigger things are up top, and the gravity takes them down, and the smaller things are down here. Philosophy is the question mark for which theology is the exclamation point. It asks the questions that the lower sciences that study lesser things can't by their very definition. I'm not saying anything bad about the sciences. It's just the limit that sciences have. They study a particular thing. They don't study universals, which means that they can't study themselves. They can study objects or phenomenon down here, but they can't ask those kind of questions. That's what the medieval scholastics meant. And the modern world, when it has its head screwed on, will admit that from time to time, and then they'll ignore it. But that is how the university developed, is that insight. So the big idea I had for all three sessions today was this, and the reason I put it down here, after giving you all that, it'll make more sense now. The dominant aim of the scholastics was to defend the whole Christian faith. And these are supposed to be in italics, and I read my notes and they weren't italicized. Oh, it is in yours. Okay, maybe, I don't know what happened to mine. But anyway, yeah, those words are important. Each of those words. The scholastics' aim was to defend the whole Christian faith on the foundation of realism through the categories of natural theology against nominalism and Islam from the megaphone of the university. That's a long, big idea, but it gives you a scope of everything that we're talking about today. Let's not forget that the two centuries in which the university is rising are the same two centuries as the Crusades. Consequently, the other important backdrop for scholasticism is the refutation of Islam. While there was a hot war of sorts of the Crusades raging, there was a cold war against the Kalam theology that was the impetus for a lot of this scholastic theologizing. The Kalam school among the Muslims was kind of their version of the Scholastics, but it meant something very particular. It's really, the best translation is from the Arabic, is words or speech. So that the juncture between philosophy and theology in this Islamic high culture saw the meaning of language as the principal intellectual problem. And there's a reason for that in their faith. It actually allows for a debate between whether the Quran is the same essence as Allah, or whether it was transmitted to a created substance such as human words. And naturally, if you're asking questions like that, snooping around the divine essence in a faith like Islam, it's naturally condemned in some of the most strident anti-intellectual Muslim circles, which pretty much won the day eventually. It goes a long way to explaining why this era of high culture in Islam declined. But even with mainline Islam's essentially low view of rationality, there was this period of time, this high culture, that permitted a degree of reflection and output. And much of this is due to the extent of leisure that naturally happens when your borders are well established. The rest, as we're going to see, is what they inherited from without, what they inherited from the West. Their best original thinker was a guy named Avicenna. There's actually two of their thinkers that made a dent in history. And these are Latinized names, by the way. His Muslim name, Avicenna, was Ibn Sina. Actually, that's shortened, too. So that's, I'll just shorten these bigger names because I don't know how to pronounce it. It just saves time. But he was a Persian who said, he was said to have written over 450 books in his lifetime. So he reconciled Plato and Aristotle and then both to the Quran. So what's happening in the Western mind is this guy's showing how Plato and Aristotle go together. In other words, how form and matter, unity and diversity go together. And this is a Muslim saying that. We don't have anybody saying the same thing. So kind of like today, when there's sort of a, this is the best analogy I can come up with, today there's this resurrection of Ayn Rand's writings, particularly with the libertarian movement picking up steam and the Ron Paul movement and so on. And so what you're going to have, and this is nowhere on the radar screen for missional people because they frankly can't think on this level, you're going to have a huge mission field of libertarian-minded thinkers who are drawing back on the Western past in spots and through a lens that's severely polluted in the case of Ayn Rand, but they're not going to have any respect for the Christian community and Christian thought because Christians, by and large, don't believe in certain Christian commitments as much as an atheist like Ayn Rand does. And so naturally, those Christians aren't going to have any respect for the church because the church is more atheistic on certain foundational principles than Ayn Rand was. And you have the same phenomenon happening here. Christian scholars, the church, were looking at these Muslims interpreting the old works of Aristotle and saying, you know what's going to happen here? Our most reflective minds are going to become more attracted either to skepticism or to Islam because their thinkers are taking seriously things that our thinkers used to, but we've neglected those things. Stark, Rodney Stark, I mentioned him last week in his book against the Defending the Crusades, he sees Islam as unable to foster scientific development because of the invasion of its deity into the cosmos. So in Stark's mind, listen to his particular critique. Providence is pit against predictability. What do you need in science? You need order. You need predictability, cause and effect. Providence messes that up, at least as the Bible defines it. But this was far from the opinion of Christian progenitors of the scientific revolution. It tells us a lot more about the Roman vision of Stark's theological, sociological constructs. He's going to criticize Islam and show you why reason didn't develop there, why science didn't develop there, but he's going to do it on false assumptions. So listen to Stark here. Thus, Islam did not fully embrace the notion that the universe ran along on fundamental principles laid down by God at the creation, but assumed that the world was sustained by his will on a continuing basis. Can you smell the false dilemma? If God made the universe orderly at the beginning, then he can't be involved or too close now. So you have a deist-like assumption projected on the Bible by Stark and assumes that providence and predictability are at odds. Stark seems to think that the universality of divine providence is something on which Muslim and Christian theology differ completely. He also seems to see the pervasive and personal decrees of God as utterly incompatible with the regularity of the natural orders. As if the more God is commanding things, the more God's forgetting the regular pattern. I mean, that is a pretty significant slap on the face of a being who's fairly omniscient and stuff. But anyway, Stark's criticisms of the modern view from his Catholic perspective actually begin from the modern definition of the intersection between supernature and nature. But there is one crucial difference between Islamic thought and Christian thought at this historical moment that Stark does get right. When the Muslims exceeded the West in the Greek tradition, it was by an inheritance and not at all by an innovation. The Muslim schools received an inheritance that the West rejected. And yet, for these four centuries, it was merely received. People will say, Islam exceeded the West in these things. It excelled the West in these things. It was ahead of the West in these things. Okay, it was ahead of the West. I thought of an analogy this morning. To say that, therefore, this is Islamic thought or Islamic innovation or Islamic excellence, that would be like me saying that for the 2 years or whatever that Josh has been in the middle room, because Aiden's too young to sleep in the same room as him, Josh's books are in Aiden's room. That would be like saying that for those 2 years, Aiden has exceeded Josh in thinking because he has those books in his room versus Josh having those books in his room. That analogy breaks down at a lot of points. But that's pretty much, I think that captures the stupidity, and you see it in all of these books. They'll all admit that the Muslims inherited all of this from Nestorian Greek monks who translated this to them. They didn't do anything innovative with it that was rational. They'll all admit that, but then on the next page, 6 inches away, they'll talk about this being Muslim genius and Christian darkness and setting those against each other. They received an inheritance that the West rejected. As Stark commented, Muslim intellectuals regarded Greek learning, especially the works of Aristotle, as virtual scripture to be believed rather than pursued. That's a good way of putting it. The notion of logical implication, of placing the particulars of nature within the superstructure of supernature, was not itself a natural implication of Islamic theology as it is in Christian theology. They had Aristotle way ahead of the West, and they sat on it. It was their relic. It was their meteor that fell down from the sky. The Greek and the Muslim mind may have disagreed on the supremacy of divinity over nature in theology, but both Greek and Muslim mind agreed that the world behaved like a person and not like the orderly, obedient creation of a person outside of it. So the Muslim Allah must be above and beyond everything else, but he has not left us a world that can be reflected upon in any advancing way. Of course, this violates our common human experience, and it explains at least part of why the double theory of truth had to be devised by one of their best philosophers, Averroes. Now, just like Aristotle in medieval literature is sometimes called the philosopher, Averroes is sometimes called the commentator. He was authoritative for that, because he translated the works of Aristotle that were not known in the West. He was a Latin-speaking Moor, and in fact there was a school that developed up through Spain and Italy, the Latin Averroists. Those who were pushing Aristotelianism into Christian lands and showing the supposed superiority of the Muslim faith as a result. And so what's happening here, and even Jews had to respond to this, philosophers like Moses Maimonides, and you can still get these books, The Guide for the Perplexed. Well, what made people so perplexed was that Jews and Christians, as much as Muslims, the monotheistic faiths were coming into contact with Aristotle and were realizing that he was on a sophisticated level showing the orderliness of the world as they believed, but believed in an eternal world as they did not believe. So they were experiencing doctrinal frontal assault on the very core of their theology from this Aristotelian philosophy. Even so, the majority of Greek texts came not from Muslim schools, but from the gradual transmission of the monks, and then the Crusader sack of Constantinople in 1204. So Christians were deriving these sources not because Muslims were innovating on them, but because they were simply translating them. And so the issue is not who got there first. The Muslim scholars had been the authorities of the Greek texts for over a century in Italy and Spain. The point is that coming into contact with the originals, coupled with the increased spread of training in Greek in the new universities, spelled the conclusion that both they and we are tempted not to draw. That the Muslim interpreters of the classics may be right or wrong. The issue for these scholastics was not who got there first, but whether or not some of what Aristotle said can be reconciled to biblical truth, and whatever can't, can be thrown out. That's sort of a myth, another myth that comes up, that especially in Thomas Aquinas, you pretty much had Aristotle light. In fact, what does Ayn Rand say? There are only three people that you can trust in the history of philosophy, and they all start with A. Aristotle, Aquinas, and Ayn Rand. At least she was humble. The only reason she liked Aquinas is to the degree that he said what Aristotle said. So you have this idea of sort of a parenthetical that he baptized Aristotle in Christianese. That is absolute nonsense and betrays the kind of person that's never read any of it. It's first of all synthesizing Plato and Aristotle and throwing out whatever. Now another thinker really gives you that approach. He shows you what these scholastics were thinking as all this knowledge is pouring in. A guy named Bonaventure. Bonaventure's dates are 1221 to 1274. He was a Franciscan monk who saw the need to answer the Muslims, not by reconciling the scriptures to Aristotle, but by subjecting Aristotle to the scriptures where he could be reconciled, or maybe if refuting him where he could not. If the works of Aristotle are forbidden, then the most reflective Christian young minds are going to blame orthodoxy, and they're going to become attracted to either pagan or Muslim thought. The surest way, Bonaventure said, is head-on, to bring these our Christian young men into direct contact with this and to meet it, to meet the challenge. Bonaventure's life doesn't matter so much. In fact, neither does this, because I got to get through the rest of this stuff. Just the idea of what he was trying to propose, to bring in the works of Aristotle and to subject it to Scripture and to show how the Christian faith was superior, who in a sense said everything that Aristotle said and more and better. The last guy that matters before Aquinas, before the third section, is this guy, Albertus Magnus in the Latin, or Albert the Great. Now, that's the exact opposite. By the way, another scholastic, just as I just thought of this again, I'm not kidding, the guy's name was Hermann the German. Yeah, Hermann the German. So, they're making progress from Charles the Bald and Bigfooted Bertha. You know, they're making a little progress here, a little evolutionary medieval namage. Albert the Great. His dates are 1193 to 1280. He was a German Dominican monk who taught at Cologne. Not to be confused with the perfumey substance. He's really the all-around expert on all things scholarly at this time, whether it was science or the Muslim commentaries of Aristotle or Aristotle directly. But Albert's greatest achievement was the investment that he made in his protege, who had become the giant among all the scholastics. And that was Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas' dates are 1225 to 1274, or as he's been known in the Catholic tradition, simply St. Thomas. And we will get back to him in the third section on the Christian philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas.